you guys had a nice weekend. Sam 1's not graded yet, but I hope we'll have it graded and then distribution everything by Wednesday. So, clearly you got knocked around a little. There was one problem which had some issues with it. I'm embarrassed to say, so I'll tell you more about that Wednesday, but don't sweat it too much. Let me get the grades and look at the exams and get the distribution, and then we'll talk about it. So, that said, until we get there, if a number shows up in Blackboard, it's sort of meaningless until we figure out. And that's sort of always true for any of my exams, because depending on the difficulty of the exam, what your numerical grading means different things. Until you see the distribution, it's hard to interpret what your number means. So if this is done right, the grades won't actually show on Blackboard until I hand things back and have the distribution. But if they do, don't lose sleep over it or go celebrate or whatever it is, because I don't know what it means until I actually see the distribution and get a sense of how that went. Alright, so last time we were talking about electromagnetic waves, and we talked about the energy flow in the waves, and one of the things that we saw is that the waves actually travel in a direction that is given by E cross B. So you can always look at a drawing of an electromagnetic wave and figure out what direction it is. And this will really help you generally sort of understand where E is relative to B. And remember, for a given electromagnetic wave, E and B are in phase and perpendicular to one another. Of course, this also tells us they're perpendicular to one another, because, well, the direction the wave goes, at any rate, is perpendicular to E and B. The average intensity, which you may see written in different ways, and this isn't meant to look like a vector, it's actually meant to have a straight bar across it. Sometimes people will signify average by putting a bar, sometimes by putting it in these angular notation. This actually comes out of quantum mechanics, at least in my experience, probably mathematics before that, but you'll see it in physics often in quantum mechanics, but it sort of comes out anyway. So sometimes you'll see it written different ways. Anyway, the average intensity then is this thing averaged over time. These both go as E and B are both vary harmonically, and so you basically have the square of a harmonic function there, and the time average over that, that pulls out a factor of 2. So you take the magnitude of whatever you have here and basically divide it by a factor of 2. And then you can rewrite the numerator in terms of your favorite combination of E and B using the fact that B is equal to E over C, and move back and forth. So these are pretty useful equations to play with at times. We also talked about radiation pressure, and I think I went off on some tangent about how stars work and the fact that radiation pressure is very important for giving you to stabilize stars against gravity. You do need to know how to play with radiation pressure and use it. Again, it is basically the energy flow divided by C. We derived that last time. And, of course, the average pressure is the average intensity divided by C. And the trick that you often get thrown at you that you have to remember is usually there'll be some wording in the problem that will give you a sense as to whether the wave is entirely absorbed or reflected. And if it's reflected, then the radiation pressure is going to go by a factor of 2. And this is sort of what you're used to from simple mechanics. But I did pull up, we actually have, this is a little spacecraft NASA sent up in 2011, and this is a big reflective mylar sheet. So they actually put up something that orbited the Earth under radiation pressure thrust. So that's sort of fun. So then I think the bulk of the class last time we talked about polarization of electromagnetic waves. And polarization basically is what you mean when you are trying to ask about what is the orientation of the electric field in this electromagnetic wave. If we have just some electromagnetic wave, you may recall that at some point in our derivation of plane waves, we said at no loss of generality, we will assume that the E field is oriented along the y-axis, and then we went and did the rest. Once you say the E field is oriented along the y-axis, then the orientation of the B field turned out to be fixed by Maxwell's equation. And the thing is, if we want a general solution, then we have to really use a basis set of two orthogonal electric fields. So if we have one, for example, where the electric field is oriented along the y-axis, and one where the electric field is oriented along the x-axis, or let's see, I guess the way we were driving, we had this Vx and that was z. So if it's oriented along the z-axis, then we have these two orthogonal E's, and then I can have an electric field that's oriented in any direction, and I can build it as a linear combination of these two. So long as you have, for the general solution, as long as you have two orthogonal pieces, you can build anything you want out of it. But these are actually independent solutions to Maxwell's equation. So within this one, you have the E is pink, and you have B that's blue, and they have a very tight relationship that's driven by Maxwell's equations. They're perpendicular to one another. E cross B gives you the direction that the wave is traveling. B is equal to E over C, and B are in phase. So there's a relationship in the amplitudes. For this piece and that piece, you don't actually necessarily have to have the electric field here be in phase with the electric field there. That is not a constraint. I suppose you probably do want the same direction, but you can vary the amplitude as well. So the magnitude of this E and the phase of this E do not necessarily have to be the same as that. So in order to really have a general discussion of polarization, what you want to do is to look at the electric field component of this piece and the electric field component of that piece and understand that the relative amplitudes of these two things and the relative phases of those two electric fields could, in fact, be different. And so now we do a shift where what I'd like to draw is not the E and the B here and the E and the B here, but I'm basically going to drop the B's in both cases. And so now I draw the E field from here and the E field that I had drawn here. And in the end, the electric field is a field, so you have superposition that happens. So the electric field at any given point is the vector superposition of those two orthogonal electric fields, whatever they happen to be at that point in space and time. Okay with that? So whatever that superposition gives you is what you would call the polarization of this overall wave. Yes? Yeah.
What does the magnitude of E cross B represent?
That's an energy.
That's the energy of the wave.
Yeah, that's the, well, E cross B in the right unit, so you divide by mu zero, is the pointing vector. And the magnitude of the pointing vector is the intensity.
Confused about being the
Yeah, so if I time average that, the magnitude of E cross B over mu zero effectively is the average intensity. And instantaneously, this is the intensity. It's the energy flow, but if I look at the magnitude of it, it's the intensity, instantaneous intensity.
Okay. Of a single pair of EMP waves.
Of, yeah, whatever that wave is. All right, so this stuff, it gets hard to draw, so I think I showed you this applet last time, which is worth playing with. So now what I'm showing are the two orthogonal pieces of the solution, the Maxwell's equation, and I'm only showing the electric field components. So I have one, which is oriented along the y. I have the orthogonal one oriented along the z. And note that the amplitudes are free to change, and I'm allowed a phase difference between the two. And so if you look at the vector superposition of the electric field of each of those pieces, in the yellow plane, that projection is what you see here, where you see the red piece and the blue piece, with the purple being the vector superposition. So I can freeze that at a moment. So if you have your eye over here, what you would see is the blue going off to the left, the red going down, and the vector superposition is that purple. Okay? And because we're basically in phase, this one goes all the way to one side and that one goes all the way down, so you have the maximum in the vector superposition when they both are at maximum, and then they go to zero, this becomes zero, and then they both go the other direction, and the vector superposition flows the other way. Maximum, zero, now it flows the other way. So if I change the phase angle between these two things, then lots of interesting things can happen. I'm going to turn on this toggle for the trace. So basically what it will now do is it will trace out where the head of the superposition vector goes. Then it will fade slowly in the course of the period. If I change the phase angle to 90 degrees, now they're exactly out of phase. And a way to picture is your eye is here, and imagine your eye is sensitive to this vector superposition. What does it look like if it goes in? As it travels into your eye, you sort of have this corkscrew for the magnitude, for the electric field vector. Its magnitude, in fact, is always fixed in this case. And it's always fixed because I'm actually right now treating these two amplitudes equal. And note that it rotates clockwise, or in counter to the right hand rule, what the right hand rule would say if the thumb was going through your eye. If I change the phase to minus 90, it's going to do the same thing, but it's going to rotate the other way. So those are two different, they're called circular polarizations of light. So it's not fixed as a function of time. and they are different because one's rotating clockwise and one rotates counterclockwise if it goes into your eye. So those go by different names. Sometimes you talk about right-handed circular polarization, left-handed circular polarization. If I'm remembering this right, but right-handed circular polarization would be when it's rotating clockwise. Left-handed would be when it's rotating counterclockwise. It can be a little bit confusing because in particle physics, you get used to talking about the spin of a particle and how it's oriented with respect to its movement, and we would call something rotating like this one to have positive velocity, and something rotating the other way to have negative velocity. So if I'm right in all that, positive velocity would be left-hand polarization, left circular polarization. You can change the amplitudes. So if I change the amplitude of one relative to the other, then you get elliptical polarization, which is just the general case. All right, circular being very special. And you can get everything in between by changing the phase angle a bit. So, at any rate, have a strong iced tea and sit down and play with this sometime. You'll find it fun. And this is available for use at frat parties. All you have to do is pull up the link. So, there you go. All right, so do you believe in this stuff? So, I have a demo here, which I think is a very cool demo. Let me show you what I have. We have a shortwave radio here. So basically, this is a device that you can think of it as sending an electron pulse, like so, very fast, up and down this this wire that you see. So you might imagine if I'm doing something like that, I'm going to create an orientation to the electric field, because clearly this is very asymmetric. So this is going to create some form of polarized wave. What I have here is nothing but a copper wire connected across a light bulb. Okay? Not what I wanted to do. Let's try this. Okay. So, oops. If I have this oriented like so, nothing happens. If I orient it like this, I get current in this wire. No current? Current. That's cool, right? That's like my favorite demo. So we have a polarized electromagnetic wave that doesn't jiggle the electrons when I'm oriented one way because the field is oscillating a different way. So it really can't do much. But when I get it like this, I get effectively an AC current in this bulb. I do this, it goes away. Because the field's doing this, not this. That's cool. So, if you've ever had Polaroid sunglasses, it's made of a material that is such that it cuts out all but one polarization of the light that's coming through. And the reason for this, we can talk about in a minute, but it turns out to be very useful. Well, I'll talk about it in a minute. It turns about out that upon reflection, if you can imagine this electromagnetic wave propagating and hitting off a mud puddle, say, out in front of you as you're driving in a car or something, it's a plane wave. You can imagine it's a plane wave coming down, and you could imagine it having two orthogonal electric fields, one oriented this way and one oriented parallel to the ground. And as it hits, it turns out that these two are not reflected in the same way. That in fact, I believe it's the parallel one is almost 100% reflected, and the other one is not reflected very well. Which means the light that comes off the mud puddle that's reflected is polarized. So now if I have sunglasses that are oriented such that they only allow light with a polarization that's perpendicular to that, then all of that light that was reflected gets stopped by your sunglasses, whereas light of other orientations comes in very freely. So it's a way to preferentially cut out the light from reflection, which is pretty cool. But if you think about it, if you now have two pairs of Polaroid sunglasses, and you totally have to do this, but I suggest that you do not do this while driving. Have someone else drive, or do it while you've actually stopped the car. If you take your pair of sunglasses and the other pair of sunglasses, and take them and do this, and now they will each cut out one orthogonal polarization and basically turn them black. So what I have here are two sunglass lenses oriented like this, so that they both let through the same polarization. But if I take one of these and I turn it to right angles to the other, you see that no light goes through. Okay, the light that's coming through from the transparency projector is unpolarized initially. So it passes through one filter, one Polaroid filter, which cuts out all the light with the polarized, all the component of the polarization that's in one direction, which turns out to cut the intensity by a factor of two. Which is why Polaroid sunglasses do sort of shade everything, because they are cutting the intensity by a factor of two, just flat out. But in addition to that, they cut out this one preferential orientation. So if I have the two sheets and I put them at right angles to one another, and so I rotate it back the other way so that the axis is now parallel again, you can see that it lets through all the light. The amount of light that gets let through is going to depend on what the angle is between the two. So if I put it at some intermediate angle, you can see I get a deeper shade. So now let me suppose that I have these. Let's have the light completely oriented, all oriented in a very particular direction. So both of them have their Polaroid axes like this. Really means that within the plastic you have long molecules that have a certain orientation and they'll absorb the light preferentially in terms of this direction. So now I'm going to put a third sheet in. And you'll note that the intensity doesn't actually change very much. And the reason that it doesn't change very much is the light is already polarized. If I put a single sheet in, you'll get approximately this intensity. The only loss in intensity that we get as I put another sheet in has to do with scattering because it's imperfect material or something. You know, sort of. There's going to be a little bit of light loss because of impurities in it or whatever. But largely, you can see the intensity has not changed. Okay? So now, I'm going to have this out. and I'm going to orient the two filters, the one on the top and the bottom, such that the light is completely cut out. Alright? And now I'm going to take the third filter and put it at a little bit of an angle, and I'm going to put it in. And look what happens. The third filter is not in. There is no light. The third filter is in. There is light. What's going on? So the first one takes only light with a certain orientation. What you're doing, remember these are vectors, right? So one only takes light this way, so you have an electric field component, and it is all oriented like this. If I then put something that only allows this orthogonal piece, there's nothing to come through. So there's zero intensity. If now I have these, but I put something that takes it and has it at 45 degrees in it, or something in the middle, okay? Now I have the first one that the light's coming through. It's all oriented this way. Then I have the second one. It is this way. The intensity's cut by a factor of 2 already. I have one that's oriented this way, and now what does it do? The electric field is like so, but there is a non-zero component of the electric field that is along this line. So that piece gets let through. It is a drop in intensity, and we'll look at it quantitatively in a minute. So this one, I put in the other one, and now it effectively changes the orientation of the electric field that transmits into the third one. Instead of being like this, it's now like that. And now the third one sees electric field with a component that is along its axis, so some of the light gets through. So effectively, the second one sort of rotates the electric field component that's coming through at a loss of intensity. So this is sort of what we're doing. So in this case, both orthogonal axes, everything is cut out. Here you put in this third piece, and so you have one polarization that's left through. This has a non-zero component. This one has a non-zero component in that direction, so you have some in that direction left through, and then the third one, you have a non-zero component on its axis, so some of it will come through. So quantitatively, we want to think about the intensity, and to think about the intensity of these problems, let's think a bit about what intensity is. Remember that the intensity, the brightness of the light, goes as the square of the electric field, or the time average of the electric field in the wave. So if I have some electric field, I have light polarized, say, along this, and it has a certain magnitude in zero, the intensity, the electric field component that comes through a polarizer that is at an angle theta with that electric field is going to be E cosine theta. So if I now put a polarizer, if I have light with a polarization in this direction, and I put a polarizer that only allows light in this direction through, it will only allow this component, the E cosine theta of the original electric field through. The square of that is a measure of the intensity. So if I have an initial intensity which goes as E zero squared, then what comes through this polarizer is going to go as E zero squared times cosine squared, or the initial intensity times cosine squared theta. And so that's basically the rule of thumb that you're going to want to use whenever you have a polarizer problem to figure out intensity. The other thing that's really useful to know, which I'm not really proving to you, although I think it's sort of plausible in terms of... And that is, if I have an original intensity of light and it's unpolarized, that it has all different orientations, if I now have a polarizer, what comes through the intensity of now cut by factor 2. So you'll want to remember that rule of thumb as well. So here it would be unpolarized. This is what we call plane polarized light as it's coming through. Plane polarized or linearly polarized. It's not necessarily circular, it's coming through with just one particular one. So in the one case, where we have just the two polarizers at right angles to one another, we have the unpolarized light from the projector coming up. It goes through the first polarizer. It now has a certain polarization with half the intensity. You now go through a second polarizer, but the angle is at 90 degrees from the first. So you have zero intensity coming through. In the other case, where I insert a third polarizer that's roughly at 45 degrees in orientation relative to the first, I have original intensity, I go through the first polarizer, I have half intensity, I go through the second polarizer, the intensity is going to be equal to what you start with on the incoming side of that polarizer, which is 1/2 times the original intensity, times the cosine squared of that angle, because of the argument that we made a moment ago about how the intensity scale. And so this now is the intensity that comes through the second polarizer, and then you get the third polarizer, and now the angle of the third polarizer with respect to the second is again 45 degrees. So this is the incoming intensity in the third polarizer, and you multiply that by the cosine squared of the angle of the third polarizer relative to the second, and this is the intensity that you end up with under those circumstances. But it's not zero, is the thing. Okay, any questions? Yes?
How did you get the half of the intensity after the first polarizer?
I didn't derive that for you. So basically, if you have things with a uniform distribution in angle, and you only allow the components coming through, the component that has one orientation, then you'll end up with half coming through. I think it's probably fairly easily provable, but I didn't bother preparing it and don't usually present it. Now that I think about it, I think I've not usually presented it because I'm usually presenting that the physics 114, and I'm not sure that may be the case. But it's sort of plausible, I think, by symmetry. Okay. So let's say we have initially unpolarized light incident on a polarizer, which has a polarization axis oriented vertically. This light then passes through a second polarizer with this polarizer axis oriented 30 degrees to the vertical. Then what is the intensity of the light transmitted through both polarizers relative to the intensity of the incident light? So it's really... And just think about that for a moment. So it's pretty similar to what we just did, right? Except so you can drop by half the intensity going through the first one, then the second one's at 30 degrees, so you take the intensity of the incoming, so that's the 1/2 of the original intensity, and you multiply by cosine squared 30. So this ratio then is going to be this intensity over the original. About 37%. So you okay with this? All right, so now what I want to do is sort of shift away from electromagnetic waves and start talking more about basic optics to the extent that optics isn't electromagnetic waves. What I had thought I would do, and may have advertised, I think it's on the syllabus, I thought of taking our solution of a plane wave and deriving how it interfaces on the surface. So deriving the law of reflection and Snell's law. And I was looking at that, and I could do it, but I think it's not really worth our while. If you take the next level up electromagnetism course, you'll certainly do it. I'm not sure when you would do it in your optics curriculum. What's the physics EM course at 217? Do optics majors take 217, or do you have your equivalent? For some step up in electromagnetic theories or stuff. Well, whatever it is, you'll almost certainly see it. It's not technically all that hard, but there are some things that I would need to show you, and it would sort of take a good 45 minutes probably to work through at a speed that makes sense. And in the end, because I know you're going to see it later, I thought it wasn't worth our while. So I'm not going to do that. I'm going to jump a little bit more straight into more the optics side of things with relatively little discussion of the what really comes out of core Maxwell's equations. But trust me when I tell you that the basic laws of optics just pop right out of Maxwell's equations. If you're actually interested in that step, like a derivation of Snell's law from Maxwell's equations, I can point you, you can just look in Griffiths, and it's a nice discussion, and you're welcome to go through that. It's certainly not above you, but there's some places where there might be some things you haven't seen before, and you have to think your way through. But if you want to look that up and want to come ask questions, feel free to do so. But you'll almost certainly see it in your next level of courses. At any rate, if you look at Maxwell's equations as we wrote them, and if you look at Gauss's law and Faraday's and Ampere's law and all those things when they're introduced to you, generally speaking, we have these symbols, the epsilon naught and the mu naught, that really look quite ridiculous when they're first introduced. You first see Coulomb's law, it's KQQ over R squared. And then it makes complete sense, because once you define what the charge is, you have the characteristic of the force where the strength drops off is 1 over R squared when you separate these things. Whatever charge is, if I have twice of it over here, I get twice the force. All that makes sense. But once you specify what your units are for distance and charge, then you have to have something that effectively converts that into a number that gives you a strength of the force. And that's what K does. It's a simple proportionality constant. So you learn about K, and that makes complete sense. And then arbitrarily, somebody says, oh, K is equal to 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, where epsilon naught is called the permittivity of free space. And everybody's sitting there going, what? Why would you do that? Why would, so you're taking a constant and you're renaming it a constant in a funny form, and you're giving it this funky name. As I say, it's always good for obfuscation. Am I saying that correctly? Is very important for job security. And this is a very nice example of that. You have a simple proportionality constant. Instead of having just K, it's 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, and you call epsilon naught something really funky. So some of this is historical, and I hope that it will begin to make sense. I mean, 122 or 142, this sounds pretty crazy when you first hear about the permittivity of free space and the permeability of free space for mu naught. The names, it's actually not of free space, sorry. So the names actually make sense when you start to consider what happens with electric and magnetic fields in materials. And the electric and magnetic fields can change in materials. So presumably you're all experts on that, but I'll just remind you. If I have an external electric field and it passes through a material, this material can be oriented of stuff that has a natural electric dipole on it. If it has a natural electric dipole and I have an electric field oriented down, right, the negative piece of that dipole is going to want to go toward the source of the electric field. The positive is going to want to go away. So you'll have a net torque on that thing. If I'm the stronger the electric field, the more torque I'll have. Now, you have an equilibrium between thermal jiggling of all these things sort of knocking their orientation around in the material and this torque that wants to orient it. So it turns out that the degree of orientation is, within certain regimes, linear with the strength of the electric field. We call this linear dielectrics. And as this stuff gets oriented, effectively, what you're doing is you're creating an induced dipole in the material where you have more negative charge on one side and positive on the other, which effectively creates a counter electric field the other way, and it cuts down the strength of the electric field in the material. You also may have neutral atoms or something, in which case, when you put them in an electric field, the electron density, the way you think about it, can actually get shifted a little bit, and it creates a dipole. And the degree of the dipole is also going to be proportional to the electric field. So again, you get a sort of linearity in the electric field. The microscopic source of it is not really so important to us. It's just an electric field in a material will be weaker than the electric field that you would have if you had a vacuum. And the degree to which it weakens is a strong function of the material. Okay? You have similar things with magnetic fields. It's a little more complicated because there's a scenario where you can actually, there are scenarios where you strengthen the magnetic fields depending on the material. But what that means is if I go through a particular material, I actually mess with the electric and the magnetic fields, and the way in which that is done we describe by these constants, the permittivity of the material and the permeability of the material, and we now drop the free space bit. So they're just constants. You want to pass something through a material, you look up what the constant is, figure out what the electric field and magnetic field would be if you wanted to put one externally on it. Until you get real serious and you're dealing with real materials, you can assume that things are linear in the external fields and there are no orientations. That's actually crap, because the minute you start dealing with many real materials, what you will find is there are, to a large extent, orientations, and you have to quantify them. Things can get a bit sticky, but we'll actually talk about one of those today. But what this means is that the original speed of the field, as you recall when we looked at the wave equations for E and B, out popped this combination of these two constants, and that was the speed of the wave when we looked at how it was in the wave equation. If we now rewrite Maxwell's equations, putting in the epsilon and the mu instead of the epsilon naught and the mu naught, then you do the wave equations and you look at them, you'll find that you get this, which is a different number. So you have a velocity for the electromagnetic wave in a material that is slower than you have in a vacuum. We quantify that generally by taking the velocity in the vacuum and dividing by the velocity in the material, and this is what we call the index of refraction. So B will be less than, or maybe approximately equal to C at best. So the index of refraction here is always going to be greater than or equal to 1. Okay? So we're going to go into lots of optics stuff. I'm sure some of you have seen this a lot in the last year. And so I'm sorry about that, but I sort of have to have it in this class for completeness. Not everybody took geometric optics last semester. whatever. So the index of refraction, again, is something that's material specific, and you can just look it up. And generally, if you are in materials, typically you don't worry about different orientations at this level of physics. When you get into real materials, you will. When I say that epsilon and u have directional dependence, that also is basically saying the index of refraction has directional dependence. And this is the origin of some really cool optical effects that we'll even talk about a little bit, but you'll run into it quite a bit. A table like this, which is out of Jean Coley, pays no attention to orientation. So these are either materials where you have no orientation, or they do some form of an average loop. But you see, typically, we take a vacuum sort of by definition as just one. Air is just a little bit off of one. You can assume that it is one unless told otherwise. I mean, you can conceive of problems where that difference is the thing that makes the whole problem work. But you can also conceive of problems where the basic, you can just assume it's one and be perfectly safe. So it's all in the wording of the problems. Water's 1.33, glasses tend to be around 1.5. And I think something happened here because I think they're supposed to be a 1. If it were 0.58, that'd be really cool. I better fix that. I think this must be Flint. Now, one aspect to all this that is an origin of some really rich phenomenon, but also a real thorn in the side of people trying to do things technically. This index of refraction varies with the frequency. Here we plot it not in frequency, but in wavelength. And you can see these maybe aren't huge effects, but, and they can be, but for glasses and things, you see some difference. And why that's a pain, we'll get to it. But it goes by the name of dispersion. So this was what I was going to derive for you, but I think I'd like to just conceptually let's look at it this way. Suppose that I have an interface. So I have glass, for example, and we're looking at it from the side, and we have a wave front coming in at an angle. So here is our electromagnetic plane wave coming in like so. Okay? And then it hits this interface where I have, say, glass down here, could be water or whatever. And we look at what happens to the successive wave fronts. And life gets interesting because the speed of the wave here and the speed in this medium are different. So what happens, I think, is actually nicely illustrated by what you might imagine if you had a bunch of soldiers marching in formation, okay, at a fixed speed here, and they're on pavement here, and suddenly they hit this place where they have fairly thick mud. So the soldiers here move slower. They're having to shove their boots in and extract them from the mud. So they simply will move at a different speed. And when that happens, you see that you effectively are going to get a shift in the angle. The distance between the soldiers here is less. Why? Look at this interface point right where the wave is hitting. This soldier is now moving more slowly than that soldier. The top soldier here is still moving on pavement, so he's moving faster. So he narrows this gap right at that interface. And then once he's in the mud, they both move at the same speed. So this effectively takes the wave front and shifts it at a certain angle. So geometrically, you can look at it here, and you can see that the wavelength, the distance between the wavefronts in the material, is shorter than the distances out here. And so we quantify that by this Snell's law of refraction. So, I think you can convince yourself that the sine of these angles, that is the distance the light goes here, I have to stop and think about it. I didn't actually think through here. I was looking at that. Look at this. Maybe next time I'll motivate. I don't want to do it on the fly here. You can motivate this expression conceptually, and you end up rewriting these velocities in terms of the definition of the index of refraction. When you do, you can get this in terms of indices of refraction. So this relates the angle of the incoming of the light on one side to the angle on the other side, and it depends on the indices of the refraction. So this is known as Snell's law. And what you can convince yourself of if you look at this is that if the light, so generally one rule is these angles are always defined with respect to the normal to the surface that you're hitting. And you can convince yourself that if I'm going from a low index of refraction to a high index of refraction, this angle will be smaller than that angle. That is, you're bent toward the normal. If you happen to be moving from high index of refraction to low index of refraction, you'll be bent away from the normal. So that's a rule of thumb you want to keep in mind. So another thing to think about is visually you just follow the wavelength changes in the material. What doesn't change is the frequency. The frequency defines the color. So the wave may be moving slower, but the wavelength is less, so that if you are sensitive to how the electric field is oscillating, you'll see the same number of oscillations per second. So the frequency stays the same. And to quantify how the wavelength changes, C over V is equal to N by definition. Lambda times the frequency is equal to the velocity. I write it in both cases where I allow the velocity, this is in the material, so the velocity and the wavelength will change. This is in a vacuum. This is the wavelength in a vacuum. Lambda nu is equal to V, and V is equal to C over N. So if I divide, if I pull N up and nu down, this is lambda zero. So this equation relates the wavelength in the vacuum to the wavelength of the material. N is greater than one, so the wavelength of the material is shorter. You'll have to keep that in mind when we start doing interference problems, including the motion of the light through materials. But what a distance means in terms of numbers of wavelengths depends on the wavelength in that material, so you always will have to keep that in mind. Okay, so if we look at it for the light going up, let me do this first. Light may not penetrate in the material, but some of the light will be reflected. And again, this one can derive from Maxwell's equations fairly simply. The way in which you derive it is you have the different E and B's on the two interfaces, be it for Snell's law or the law of reflection. And it turns out that there are rules governing the components of the fields. Field components that are parallel or perpendicular to the surface. And so you have to have continuity in the electric and magnetic fields going across the surfaces for certain orientation. And that actually allows these angular equations to be kicked out. Anyway, so for the law of reflection, the angle of incidence defined with respect to normal is equal to the angular of reflection. So if it's a smooth surface, then basically all the rays conform cleanly to that. I mean, they'll always conform cleanly to that, but if at a macroscopic level, you can see that. So for example, if I have rays of light confined, I will only see them here but not here because of the way in which they reflect. This is known as specular reflection. You can have a rough surface, in which case the law of reflection still holds true, but now because you have a rough surface, you have different angles here, and so the light gets diffused out. So that's known as diffuse reflection. So think of the specular as off the surface of a mirror, and this would be off some rough surface. Okay, so if we look at Snell's law, let's imagine that we have, there's the normal. We have light that is incident from N1 to N2, and let's have N1 greater than N2. So this might be something, for example, like water, so you have a higher N than air up here, for example. Or it could be inside the glass and going to outside. And let's imagine that we have a ray of light that is incident . Usually the incident angle is given theta sub I. So the angle, so you're moving, the light is moving from high index to low index, and the rule of thumb is when you go from high to low, the angle that comes out is bent away from the normal. If I were to slowly increase this angle, as I move this angle out, this angle continues to get larger and larger as well, because Snell's law enforces that. But I'll reach a point where this angle is now equal to 90 degrees. That is, the light no longer actually penetrates. It's no longer really refractive. Its refraction is literally along the surface. So when I reach that point, we say that the angle of incidence is the so-called critical angle. So when this angle reaches a certain size, then theta sub I we define as theta sub c, which is the critical angle. And that happens to be the angle when this ray is at 90 degrees to the angle of incidence. So if that's true, N1 sine theta I is equal to N2 sine theta refracted, theta R is equal to 90 degrees, so the sine is equal to 1 at 90 degrees. So at the critical angle, sine theta sub C is going to be equal to N2 over N1. If theta I is any bigger than that, all of the light is reflected. So basically what happens is you have the refracted ray that goes down and finally it hugs the surface, and then it just penetrates into the material and it's all reflected. And it turns out that when you calculate these things, you will also have a reflected ray at most interfaces. And one of the things you can calculate is how the intensity refracted and the intensity reflected varies depending on the angle, which can also depend on the materials. So if the incident angle is greater than the critical angle, all the light is internally reflected. Any questions? You all have seen this how many times? It's not part of the problem with this class. Some of you may actually not have seen this in principle, so I have to go through this stuff. And we will do lots of problems with it. And I apologize if you've seen it many times before, but hopefully that means it's easy for you. Okay, where am I going now? So here is a beautiful scene where the you have a scene reflected off the water. Is this picture right side up or upside down? And how do you know? Why do you think it's upside down? The bottom picture of what?
The bottom half is the sun under the ground.
What is that?
And the top is the tree. So the angle is
we have a smooth water surface. We have the sun here. We have a Dr. Seuss tree. Okay. And, you know, so we're over here. And there's our eye. So light from the sun here goes through the tree directly to our eye, or almost directly to our eye. Light that gets reflected off the water comes like that. So the reflected ray we see, we would perceive the sun to be beneath the tree, and the there's the light. So if you think about it, you have to perceive on the scenery on the side, the sun has to appear higher up for what you see, for the direct rays. Because the reflected ray has to do something like that. So I this is in Gene Coley, and I pulled the picture off of another place, actually. And I was looking at it, and I didn't actually realize what I was looking at. And I'm staring at it, and I'm like, something's not quite right. And then I looked at the source where I got it. And it was, you know, I decided already, this has to be upside down. And then it says, you know, I think Gene Coley's caption says, you know, is it upside down or not? And I was like, oh, okay. I'm not stupid. Okay, I might be, but not provably because of that particular thing. Incident on surfaces due to Snell's law. So you can imagine having an object where we have a surface like this and a surface like that. So let's say that we have glass here, where we have the two surfaces at angles to each other. And now imagine if we have light incident at this angle. I guess I should be thematically consistent. What do I have up here? Pink normal and orange light. Alright. So we have our pink normal. And let us suppose we have light incident at some angle here. It now is going from, and it's in air, so it's now going from low end to high end. So it gets bent toward the normal a bit. So theta r is smaller than theta I. And it goes and it hits the other surface. Now it's going from high end to low end, so it gets bent away from this. I gotta get the colors right. So in this case we get bent toward the normal, in this case we get bent away from the normal. The exact degree of this bending depends on this index of refraction relative to that there. But you can see that you can bend light by putting it through surfaces like this. So this will lead us to a study of lenses or thin lenses. So you can create glass with these kinds of shapes. This would be known as a convex lens. This would be known as a concave lens. If you ever have any problem remembering which is which, think of this as a little cave, and it's concave. Okay? So, yeah, it's a little scary what goes through my mind through the day to sort of get through the day. Little cave, yeah, so that's the way it is. All right, so convex, concave, because this is a little cave. And so if you take this kind of conceptual thinking and you look at what's happening, if you have a convex lens, if I had rays of light coming in like so, this one hitting is a situation quite similar to what we have up here. So it'll get bent this way. This one will get bent up. Okay, it's the same thing except upside down. And the one that comes effectively straight through hits both at the normal, so it doesn't get bent at all. So you'll end up, in this case, with the rays of light getting bent. Like so. And they'll come to a point over here, which you call the focus. If we do it with the concave lens, it's sort of backwards. If I have a ray of light hitting here, it's going to be like this upside down, so it's going to end up getting bent away. One here goes straight, one here gets bent away. This is... got to remember it. This is also known as a diverging lens, because the light coming in straight diverges as it leaves. This one is known as a convex lens or a converging lens. And I hear the bell tolla, so I think I am out of time. We'll come back to geometrical optics next time. Probably will show you some stuff that you may not have seen, because I have some stuff on eyes of the animal kingdom, which is pretty cool. So, at any rate, see you Wednesday.